Today's critique examines the academic white paper, No Wound Denied, No Wound Enthroned, which uses a life-coherent framework to explore how Holocaust memory can be conserved to prevent all forms of genocide, rather than being captured by institutional self-preservation.
Yeah, and I mean, the conceptual depth here is just exceptional.
It really is. So because the material is already so structurally robust, we're going to pivot immediately into high-level editorial refinement to just maximize the reader's engagement and the paper's ultimate impact.
Right, let's dive right in.
So to maximize the impact of this profound material, we first need to look at how the reader enters the text and whether the opening sections invite them in or block their path.
Yeah, the entry point is crucial.
Exactly.
The current sequencing front-loads disparate conceptual frameworks and a really highly specific AI case study before establishing the primary historical argument, which creates a huge barrier to entry for the reader.
It really does. I mean, you open the document, and right there at the beginning, you are deep into an author's note about how frontier AI models refuse to generate visual diagrams for the paper due to their internal safety filters.
Which is wild.
Right. It is the striking anecdote, and it's clearly intended as a modern proof of principle for what the author calls procedural capture.
Ah, right.
The idea that a system will just blindly follow its internal compliance protocols, even when it obstructs a legitimate, life-coherent analysis of genocide.
Exactly.
But placing it right at the beginning, it feels kind of like being handed the complex schematics of an engine plus a highly detailed troubleshooting guide for a specific software glitch before you have even been shown the car.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a perfect analogy.
Because, you know, the reader hasn't yet grasped the magnitude of the actual historical thesis regarding Holocaust memory and the Gaza stress test. The profound thesis is just buried under methodological throat clearing.
Yeah, they are forced to juggle, what, the AI safety guardrails, six separate safeguards, a five-step hermeneutic, and incredibly dense terminological definitions right out of the gate.
It's just too many abstract concepts at once.
Well, I kind of understand the impulse behind this structure, though. In academic writing, there is immense pressure to build an airtight fortress of definitions before you make a single vulnerable claim.
Oh, sure.
The author wants to ensure we have the exact vocabulary needed to understand the atrocity.
The trap they fall into here, however, is treating the methodology as the hook.
Right.
So, the suggestion here is to reorganize the structure to let the central historical thesis breathe immediately. They need to move the AI proof of principle and the dense methodological definitions out of the opening and integrate them organically where they become actively relevant.
That would make such a difference. If it were my draft, I would take the entire author's note regarding OpenAI's safety filters and just move it to section 19.
The one on policy and institutional implications?
Yeah, exactly. Or they could even create a new dedicated section titled Contemporary Autopoiesis, AI and Procedural Capture, but just place it much later in the paper.
I love that. Think about how that changes the reading experience.
It completely transforms it.
Because if the reader encounters the AI anecdote after they already deeply understand procedural capture from the historical context of the 1940s, it's no longer a confusing detour.
No, it becomes a sudden, chilling revelation of how these exact bureaucratic mechanisms are still operating today.
Exactly. Now, what about the heavy methodology sections, like the hermeneutic definitions stacked in sections 3 and 4?
We need to apply that same organic integration there. Instead of stacking those definitions, introduce the concepts of the life ground and autopoiesis directly inside Section 6, which covers the Holocaust as a historical rupture, or Section 8.
Section 8 is the one asking what was being conserved, right?
Yeah. Just explain the definitions organically as they apply to the Nazi system. So instead of explicitly numbering and listing the definitions in a vacuum, you introduce the terms while describing the self-preserving tendency of the Nazi bureaucratic machine.
Grounding it in actual history, that is so much better.
It gives a real-world face to a very abstract term.
Okay, so building on the need to clear the structural pathway at the beginning of the text, we must also address how the paper's internal mechanics affect the reader's momentum once they are fully immersed in the argument.
the internal pacing.
Exactly. The frequent reliance on dense, overlapping, numbered lists and tables dilutes the moral resonance of the core arguments by reducing profound ethical concepts into rigid catalogs.
Oh, I completely agree. You flip through the middle sections, and the visual layout is intensely schematic.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second, though. I have to ask, are all these numbered lists strictly necessary for academic rigor? Or do they risk creating a bureaucratic reading fatigue where the audience starts skimming the numbers and misses the gravity of the actual moral claims?
It's definitely the latter. Analytical clarity doesn't actually come from the numbers. It comes from the causal relationships between the ideas.
Right.
When an audience encounters list after list, they stop reading for meaning and start reading for completion. They just skim the bolded text. You know, you were hit with 6 safeguards, 5 analytical questions, 6 beneficiaries of inception, 6 transformations, 12 principles, and 7 limitations.
It's just exhausting. But there's also a really deep irony here, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. The mechanical formatting actually mirrors the very thing the paper is actively warning against.
Procedural capture.
Exactly. The entire text is this passionate, prophetic critique of procedural capture and administrative flattening.
Right. It's arguing that atrocities happen when institutions turn living beings into categories and files.
And yet, the paper categorizes its own ethical response into 12 principles and 6 transformations. It's heavily serialized, which severely undercuts the passionate voice of the author.
So, the suggestion here is to synthesize the overlapping lists into cohesive narrative prose. We need to group related concepts into unified, thematic pillars, rather than relying on itemized bullet points.
Let's play with how this actually works on the page. Like, look at section 16.
Oh, right. The 12 principles.
Exactly. You have the 12 principles for life-coherent remembrance there, and that's immediately following the 6 transformations in section 15.
That is just so many bullet points.
It is 18 bullet points, back to back. If I'm editing this, I mean, I'm combining those 18 points into maybe 3 core ethical mandates.
Like grouping them thematically?
Right. We could conceptualize them around themes like truth and specificity, reciprocal protection, and life ground repair, and write them out as flowing paragraphs.
And by writing them out as flowing continuous paragraphs, you force the reader to engage with the philosophy rather than just checking off items on a list.
Exactly.
How would we apply that synthesis to the historical analysis sections? Say section 7, which lists the 6 beneficiaries of the Nazi system.
Right now, those beneficiaries sit in isolated silos, numbered 1 through 6. The Nazi party state, Aryan Germans, the property transfer system, the war economy, and so on.
Instead of explicitly numbering them, weave them into a single, compelling narrative paragraph about the functional beneficiaries of the system.
Right. You could write something like, "The mythic purity demanded by the party state rapidly fueled an expansion of bureaucratic power, which in turn required massive material expropriation through the property transfer system."
Which ultimately funded the war economy and imperial expansion.
Yes, look at what just happened there. You didn't lose any analytical rigor. In fact, you gained it because you demonstrated the causality. A numbered list just tells me these 6 things existed simultaneously.
But a narrative paragraph shows me the circulatory system of the atrocity.
Exactly. It proves how one bureaucratic function actively feeds the next.
Okay, so once the structure is breathing and the rigid lists are transformed into flowing emotional prose, the focus must shift to ensuring the transition between the paper's theoretical framework and its most urgent contemporary application is fully realized.
And the stakes in this section are just monumental.
They are. But the transition from the abstract framework of the autopoetic security state to the specific geopolitical reality of Gaza lacks the connective tissue needed to show exactly how these institutional failures manifest in practice.
Well, let me push back a bit here, or at least ask a clarifying question.
Sure.
The paper meticulously defines autopoetic drift and procedural capture early on, but when it reaches the Gaza section, the analysis remains quite high level. I mean, shouldn't we demand at least one grounded, real-world example of an institution doing exactly what the theory describes during the specific crisis?
Absolutely. That is the exact weakness here. Section 12 establishes Gaza as a moral stress test and accurately maps the international legal proceedings, but it doesn't explicitly run the paper's 5 analytical questions against a concrete, documented instance of memory capture during this event.
It relies heavily on high-level summaries of UN commissions or ICJ rulings.
Right. And because the paper relies so heavily on demonstrating structural, institutional complicity, relying solely on those high-level summaries leaves the application feeling slightly theoretical rather than definitively proven on an institutional level.
I almost wonder if the author is intentionally maintaining that high-level view to avoid getting bogged down in the controversies of a live conflict.
That's a valid editorial concern.
Because if you pick a hyper-specific event from last month, you risk the paper becoming instantly dated, or dragging the reader into a tangent about the semantic nuances of one specific press release.
It is a risk, but the text really needs to anchor the theoretical transition by applying the specific methodological framework to one highly specific real-world example of institutional memory failure regarding Gaza.
So we need to see it happening in the middle management layer, not just in massive international courts in The Hague.
Exactly. The suggestion is to take one specific, documented instance, for example, a specific memorial institution's public statement during the ICJ provisional measures.
Or even a specific university's administrative response to student protests.
Yes. And explicitly analyze that single event using the paper's five questions.
The life ground, boundary, conservation, autopoetic, and repair questions.
Demonstrate exactly how procedural capture played out in that specific press release or policy decision, showing the framework in action rather than just stating that it applies globally.
Let's do a mock application right now to show how illuminating this could be for the reader.
Let's do it.
Let's take a hypothetical but highly representative university PR statement that suppresses a student protest while using the bureaucratic language of campus safety and historical sensitivity.
Okay, so we take the paper's five analytical questions and run the statement through them. First, the life ground question. Did the institution's statement protect the real conditions of physical life, or did it merely protect institutional comfort?
Right. And second, the boundary question. Who was actually included in their circle of empathy? When the statement invokes safety, was it recognizing the physical safety of all students, or only a specific demographic whose discomfort threatened alumni-donor relations?
That is a piercing question. Third, the conservation question. What was the university actually conserving? Was it conserving a profound, life-coherent truth about historical trauma? Or was it conserving its own endowment, funding streams, and public reputation?
By showing the framework, rip the mask off a standard administrative PR statement like that, you give the reader an unforgettable moment of clarity.
You prove that procedural capture isn't just the historical phenomenon of the 1940s.
Exactly. It bridges the gap between the monumental history of the Holocaust and the subtle, bureaucratic ways that the phrase never again gets neutralized in the modern administrative state.
It demonstrates exactly how moral complicity still arrives with files, respectable speech, and risk management protocols.
And it makes the tool incredibly actionable. If you show them how to dissect an institutional press release, you have just handed them a pair of X-ray glasses.
I love that.
They can now use your five questions to evaluate every institutional statement they encounter.
Which is really the ultimate goal of a framework like this. So let's recap the main points.
Sounds good.
To elevate this already rigorous and essential material, the author should restructure the heavy front matter to let the core historical thesis shine immediately.
Right. Move that AI anecdote and the dense methodology deeper into the text.
Second, synthesize the numerous numbered lists into flowing thematic prose to maintain moral resonance and avoid bureaucratic reading fatigue.
Keep the profound prophetic voice front and center.
And finally, ground the abstract theoretical transition to the Gaza stress test with a highly concrete, real-world institutional example.
Applying the five questions directly to it.
Exactly. These refinements are really just about ensuring the delivery mechanism matches the profound moral resonance of the argument itself.
The author has built a remarkable framework here.
They really have. We invite you to implement these structural and narrative refinements, and please submit your revised work back to the critique for another look.
We would absolutely love to see the next iteration.
Thanks for joining us.